Welcome. You are listening to the UC Davis Center for Poverty Research Seminar Series. I'm the Center's Director, Ann Stevens. This series brings scholars and policy experts from around the country to discuss their work on poverty and poverty research. In May 2012, we hosted Ariel Khalil, who is a professor in the Harris School of Public Policy and director of the Center for Human Potential and Public Policy at the University of Chicago. Here is Khalil presenting her seminar, Diverging Destinies, Maternal Education and the Gradient in Time with Children.
This is a great, such a nice invitation. So nice to be here. I just want to acknowledge my co-authors, Rebecca Ryan, who's an assistant professor at Georgetown University in the psychology department, and Michael Corey, who is a graduate student in sociology at Chicago and is working with me on these projects. As Marianne said, I have recently discovered the merits of time use data for thinking about investments in children and trying to think about how can we ask questions that are relevant to developmental psychology using time use data, you know, which is these data are not going to give us the kinds of deep measurement of parenting, and they aren't going to give us any measures of child outcomes. But I'm going to, you know, try to show you today how I think they can be used in a really interesting way to think about differences in the kinds of investments that parents make, and especially parents with different characteristics and social backgrounds. This is the motivation for this paper, which was actually a part of Sarah McClanahan's presidential address at the PAA meetings a couple years ago. Sort of apropos, that's the PAA meetings start tomorrow in San Francisco. As you may know, Sarah McClanahan is a sociologist, and what she was documenting here is what she observed, and of course many others have also observed, as this striking increase in inequality in many different dimensions across the kinds of investments that children were getting to promote their achievement and health and well-being. And in particular, she pointed to parental education as a sort of key driver of inequality, both in terms of parents' time and also in terms of the kind of economic or financial investments that kids were getting. And as she argued, you know, we're just seeing this bifurcation in the sense that more advantaged children with more advantaged parents were increasingly getting more of everything in terms of parents' time and money and all the other kinds of resources that those investments come with, whereas the children born to the least advantaged mothers were getting increasingly fewer of all those other of those same kinds of investments. So as I said, what I really want to focus on in this paper is parental time, and specifically the kind of parental time that's spent in active, interactive engagement with children, the kinds of time, in other words, that developmental psychologists think is the most fruitful and the most beneficial for children's development. So we're certainly not the first people to think of parental time as an important input into child development. In fact, I think this is actually one of the most interdisciplinary kinds of frameworks you could imagine, in the sense that many different fields have thought about parental time as a key resource. And I can just tell you briefly, you know, what I think economists and sociologists and what I know a little bit more of in terms of what developmental psychologists have to say about parental time as a resource. So, you know, the standard model in economics of household production views child development, the sort of production of child quality in economic terms, as this output of parental investment in both time and money. Parents invest time and money in their children because they derive utility from the child quality that it produces. I mean, this actually is, you know, very similar to the views that these other fields hold. So just slightly different terms, but really the same concept. In terms of actually studying parental time use, I would say that that's been largely the purview of sociology. So these big time use data sets have been developed by sociologists. People like Suzanne Bianchi, who's now at UCLA, are really the leading experts in looking at parental time. And sociologists view parents' time as the primary means by which parents socialize their children and pass on values and social norms and information and social capital to their children. And this is really, Jim Coleman really addressed this point originally in saying that the home environment and the specific ways that parents interact with their children in the home is really the root of inequalities that we see later in development. And developmental psychologists have long been interested in what we maybe more simply call parenting and the ways in which parents and children interact. And we've long regarded parents as key figures in the development of children and have at a much more micro level study. I mean, that doesn't sound like, you know, sounds pretty straightforward, doesn't it? that parents would be important. And we have, you know, studied in great detail the kinds of parent-child interactions that, that the field believes promotes child well-being. And in particular has identified certain types of parenting that arguably reflect better kinds of time and higher quality time in the sense that they produce superior child development in different realms. So one of the key things that we know about parental time with children is that it varies regularly across different levels of parental education. And largely, the time use data has shown that it's the quantity of parental time that varies across levels of parental education. And going back, you know, many years, Frank Stafford and others, who are some of the original economists looking at time use data, have shown, and this is kind of a puzzle, that high SES mothers spend more time overall with children. And why I say that's a puzzle is because arguably their time would be more valuable outside the home. But they nevertheless show, you know, regularly higher levels of time spent with their children inside the home. And, you know, this kind of basic correlation has been replicated really in time use studies all around the world. And more recently, people like John Gurian, Frank Furstenberg, and others have shown that not only do parents with higher levels of education spend more time with children, they spend more time in quote-unquote enriching activities with their children. And so this falls along the lines of sort of teaching and educational kind of stimulation. Hillary. A married, a phenomenon of being married.
Right, which we know is, has higher rates among more educated women.
Exactly. Yeah.
Their time balanced off of the fact that there's more income in the household overall.
Yeah. You know, there's, I should say I don't know, because these studies, I mean, obviously, less educated women are going to be more overrepresented among unmarried women. So there's not, I don't know of a study offhand that has looked at what this so-called education gradient looks like. I mean, you could imagine it would be less steep,
right.
Because, you know, but it's not, I don't know. I mean, we are, you know, here we're just looking at the total effect. I mean, we're looking at the, I'll be showing you the kind of total population of married and single mothers together. So, the good question. Yeah. Kristen.
Could it possibly be curvilinear if you actually looked at high income, high education levels? Some of Luthar's work coming out on sort of the social
oh.
high income, where you then not spending time with your children? Have people looked at that at the other end of the spectrum?
So that extremely, so we're looking at education.
Plus very wealthy, that some of these things might go away.
Yeah. I don't know that either.
Mm-hmm. Would be interesting because there, she's finding a lot of risk factors with really high income families, as you find in poverty risks too. So
right.
To what happens on that
right. Spectrum. I mean, I don't know. Are those risks she's talking about vis-a-vis parents' time with children, or
yeah? She talks a little bit about
Okay. Yep. Yeah, okay. And then, you know, just finally, one interesting thing is there's some new, a new paper by the Ramies, you may know of it, that has suggested that this quote-unquote education gradient in parental time has actually increased over time, which is sort of relevant to the general phenomenon I'm talking about. There's, you know, people debate whether this is true, and in fact, the time diary data we have at our disposal, in fact, are not totally ideal for looking at these secular changes in time. But if their paper offers some provocative hypotheses, and theirs is largely that there has been this sort of increasing demand among the high educated for producing like super high quality kids to get them into super competitive colleges, and that has driven ever increasingly these kind of hysterical parent time investments in children. And that's their argument. And I should say also, this is just to let you know that I don't think anyone has a particular theory about whether there's some ideal amount of time to be invested in children. I mean, developmental psychology and no other field that I know of has sort of mapped out whether they're, you know, what's the actual relationship between number of minutes in some particular activity and some particular level of child outcome that we think arguably represents some distinct difference from some other level of that child outcome. So I'm going to be talking throughout about basically, you know, more or fewer minutes of time, but I'm not working towards any kind of final assessment about what, and no one else has either, about sort of what's the, you know, the ultimate package of parental time we should be striving for. Okay, so that, as I said, lays this, the lay of the land for talking about what I said is called this education gradient in parental time. And as I said, I mean, it's really indisputable at this time that this correlation exists. But what we want to introduce here is this notion of what we're calling the developmental gradient in parental time, which argues, and I'll tell you why I think this is plausible in a moment, that maternal education shapes not only the amount of time that parents spend with their children, but possibly also its composition. And in other words, that highly educated mothers alter the composition of their time to respond to children's developmental needs. And by definition, children's developmental needs change as children grow older. And so what we are arguing here is that this education gradient that others have observed in the data can actually be characterized by a developmental gradient, and that more educated mothers will... the pattern of time use that more educated mothers will display will be characterized by this developmental gradient to a greater extent than their less educated counterparts. And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about what I mean by all of this, but you know, we will argue that this sort of developmentally sensitive kind of parenting time is another important element in the inequalities that we observe across groups of children. Okay, so again, trying to draw from a couple of different fields in terms of why should education relate not only to the levels of time investment, but to its composition. Here again, I think we can draw from economics, sociology, and again, developmental psychology. So again, in very broad terms, in economics, education is arguably related to individuals' efficiency, so that choices in time use are made to maximize certain goals and certain outcomes. Bob Michael, Gary Becker, and others have argued that this kind of efficiency in non-market behavior can be observed in kind of home production. And so we argue that that could equally well be observed in terms of parents' time with children, which is a big component of home production. And one way of thinking about that, again, in very broad strokes, is to say that if you think about parental efficiency or parental effectiveness, you say parenting efficiency, people don't really like that, the way that sounds, so can say kind of parental effectiveness, how might we observe that in time use data? We could observe it if we think that parents are minimizing the amount of time they spend on activities that are arguably less relevant for children of a particular age and maximizing their time on activities with children that are arguably more relevant. And here we're using children's age as sort of the benchmark for what is and isn't relevant, but you could think of other dimensions of children that could be equally plausible. And, of course, there's lots of individual differences in children. So simply saying 3-year-olds need this and 10-year-olds need that is really broad, is super broad from a developmental psychologist perspective because there's lots of individual differences. But that's the framework we're operating with in this paper. We haven't found any paper in economics that has kind of looked at parenting behavior from this kind of efficiency perspective. But Annette Leroux in sociology has done a lot of qualitative work that kind of draws on these same themes. In her qualitative work, she finds that middle-class parents engage in a very different kind of parenting style than their working class counterparts, in which essentially middle class parents do this what she calls concerted cultivation of children, spending the kinds of time with children and promoting their participation in activities that will be rewarded in the schools and arenas in which those children will eventually go on to inhabit, and in a very, as the term implies, a very concerted way, sort of a particular set of activities to promote what children, will eventually hope to accomplish. Whereas she reports that working class parents adopt what she called this accomplishment of natural growth strategy, where parents certainly attend to their children's emotional and physical needs, but otherwise sort of assume that children will develop just fine. As long as lots of, again, not to imply that all parents aren't focusing on the well-being of their children, but that for this one group of parents, there's no need for this elaborate strategy and plan. And she argues that this perpetuates this sort of inequality in the kinds of opportunities that children will go on to have, because certain of these characteristics that children will develop will go on, as I said, to be rewarded in school and in the labor market and so forth. And again, that's a kind of very small-scale qualitative study. Yeah, Anne? Okay.
I've never worked with. And this point about some of the more, I think, ethnographic qualitative research on what parents are doing.
Yeah.
I've always wondered if one thing about more educated parents is that they spend their time use differently when they write down in a time diary.
Oh, yeah.
And so I wonder if we know anything about how time diary evidence lines up with the more sociological observation driven, with an outside observer characterizing the time.
I think that the time use patterns that I will show you today will, line up with some of these qualitative observations, but the limitations of time diary data in terms of what parents say they do is, I think, very real. And I think the problem is you're suggesting is they can vary systematically across parents with different levels of education. So, parents actually rarely are doing only one thing, as it turns out, in the data. They're doing, and the kind of time that they spend with children in quote-unquote primary time minutes is very small relative to the amount of time they're spending in terms of kind of secondary time minutes. We don't actually know which one of those is better for child development, so let me say that. But I'm going to show you primary time minutes, and I'm going to argue that there's these differences. But it could very well be that parents with different characteristics differentially report what they're doing. I mean, if you're watching TV and talking to your child, or you're doing the dishes and talking to your child, which one of those is the thing you say you're doing? I'll tell you about the data in a minute. They ask which is the main thing you were doing, and then they say, were you doing anything else? So that's the kind of choice point where I think we have very little information on who reports what But it's a good, so you should definitely bear that in mind. And then finally, as I said, thinking about the parenting literature from developmental psychology, really the hallmark of what we would call effective parenting is sensitive parenting. What do we mean? I mean, we could say that sensitive parenting, to be a sensitive parent, means that you respond contingently to your child's needs. And in principle, children's needs change as they go through different developmental periods. So that parents who kind of respond in these dimensions we observe in the time diary data to what we argue are the needs of children in broad strokes in those different developmental periods could be thought of as more developmentally sensitive than their counterparts who don't. And again, it's sort of a regular observable correlation in many different studies that high SES parents interact more sensitively with children on average, and this is across a variety of ways of defining sensitivity. All right. So, as I said, this will just be sort of a little detour into developmental psychology. I often give this talk to audiences where there are no other developmentalists in the room, so just spend 1 minute. And as I said, children require different types of parental interactions in different periods of their development. And, we distinguish in our data across four very broadly defined developmental periods. So in infancy, really the paramount concern of parenting is to provide basic care for children. So in the first year of life, really, the central tasks are to help infants establish regular sleeping and eating routines and develop those initial capacities for self-regulation. And where does that come from? That comes from regular sensitive interactions from parents in feeding, bathing, soothing, physically caring for children, a whole suite of activities that, we can just call basic care. And not only do those interactions attend to children's physical needs, but are also extremely important arenas for the development of social and emotional attachments to parents. So if their socio-emotional development comes out of these interactions very much as well. As children age, they obviously become capable of initiating and maintaining social interactions, having representational thoughts that allow them to engage in symbolic or pretend play. And this is a very important developmental skill for children in promoting their cognitive and social development. And one of parents' major roles during this developmental stage is to help scaffold and engage and encourage children in those early kinds of activities. Which, as I say, will promote attention, vocabulary, numeracy and literacy, creativity, and really, the foundations of all the kinds of things we think of as school readiness and the kind of building blocks of learning that, many of us study at later stages. So how do parents do this? We argue it's really through play. So playing games, creative activities like art projects, pretend play, these are the kinds of parent-child interactions that we argue facilitate these cognitive needs and capabilities at this stage of life. During the preschool period, as children advance in their cognitive and attention skills, they have an increasing appetite for sort of education-like activities in book reading, problem solving, doing puzzles and the like. And again, many people know that these kind of early skills are a critical element of what developmentalists and others call school readiness. We know in the data that there's already big gaps in school readiness by the time children across SES groups, by the time children even begin their formal schooling. And so we argue that, what we could call teaching is a paramount parental activity during this stage of life. And we can observe this, again, in the time use data, but in other studies as well, with activities like reading with the child, simply talking and engaging in conversation. Homework is not really relevant for preschooler. But, as I said, mainly these kind of school readiness activities. And then finally, in a developmental period that we're characterizing very broadly here, we're sort of leaving out, there are developmentalists would take a more fine-grained approach to a period we're calling middle childhood, which spans from 6 to 13 years. We're really calling management the primary activity. So maybe everyone can relate to that. I mean, children increasingly have worlds that expand outside the home to peers and schools and extracurricular events. Parents need to monitor those social networks. Parents play a big role in helping to select their children's peers and the activities they participate in. And children, begin to learn the tasks of forming relationships with others beyond their parents, learning self-control, adopting a sense of kind of personal efficacy in the choices that they make, and this kind of parental behavior in terms of really managing children's lives outside the home, we argue, becomes relevant at this stage. Yeah, Marianne.
I guess we have a better sense of what you mean by what children require. So is this sort of what's thought of as needed for good emotional development or good?
Both, actually.
Attachment theory.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think this is a lot in the first 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
Everything on that list would make me think of that attachment theory. Those are all sort of things you can do without a child attaching to you, right? Do you see what I'm saying? Is this about what you need to do to have a need to do? Is this sort of the formula for a child succeeding academically or emotionally?
No, I would say very much both. I mean, what I would say is that these different developmental periods, as I said, sort of require or demand different kinds of parental inputs, which are more, and many of them are the same. I mean, basic care children need, until they're teenage. I mean, until they leave the house and have to feed themselves. That certain of these developmental or parenting tasks are more or less relevant at these different ages, because the kinds of interactions that go along with, the kinds of interactions that parents and children engage in when they do these different activities is responsive, sort of provides the avenue or the opportunity for parents to support their children's development in a variety of realms. I think there's nothing here that says that this is only about academic achievement or cognitive development. It's very much about these are the kinds of activities that will help to promote children's emotional and cognitive development. But it's really more that reading to the child, in utero has been, pretty much in the developmental. I mean, that's just sort of silly. I mean, there's no argument, developmentally that says that that's sort of an effective use of time. But reading to the child, in toddlerhood and preschoolhood is very much an effective use of time, because children have the capabilities to respond to those parental investments, and that their capabilities, their ability to respond changes as they get older.
Yeah. So I'm outside of the scope of this specific study.
Okay.
I was wondering what the theoretical activity would be after this middle childhood. Would it continue to just be management once the kid was an adolescent? Or does it shift to be
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. I mean, as you'll see from the data I'm going to show you, the kind of the level of parent primary time that parents actually spend with children diminishes greatly as children get older. And by the time they're in this 6 to 13-year-old group, it's actually a fairly minimal number of minutes. I mean, I could certainly argue that there's other kind of parenting time that would be relevant for 14 to 18-year-olds. Much of this, I also have to admit, is data-driven. Okay, so we have a limited set of things we can observe in the time use data. And, you know, we're trying to map it on as best we can to what we think is a kind of sensible theoretical framework. And, you know, that sort of drove our, you know, we just don't have as fine-grained kinds of time use as we might hope to be able to say, you know, anything more than beyond these sort of broad. And as I'm going to show you in a minute, we're actually going to collapse the sort of toddlerhood and preschool period. It's also a question of sample size. We don't have actually enough, you know, if we had a bazillion people, we could, you know, make much more fine-grained groupings because we would have a sufficient number of parents of children at much narrower age bands. Hovering? Yeah. Eavesdropping, yeah. Right. 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 Yeah. Okay. So let me just say, you know, again, like what kind of hypotheses we would then develop based on what I've told you so far. So if there were to be a quote-unquote developmental gradient, I mean, how would we know it when we see it? And the first is that we would argue that this developmental gradient could manifest in two different ways. The first is that highly educated parents would invest more time in an activity when it is developmentally important than at other stages of development. Okay, so given what I just told you is the sort of what's appropriate when, that we should see that highly educated parents, for example, would invest more time in basic care during children's infancy than they would during the children's preschool or middle childhood period, okay? Which is, again, not to say that basic care isn't important at other stages, but that given our theories that this is the paramount concern of parents of infants, that's when we should see the emphasis on basic care. The other way that we could see this developmental gradient is that highly educated parents should tailor their child-rearing time to their children's developmental needs to a greater degree than their less educated counterparts. So in other words, just because highly educated parents sort of concertedly cultivate or efficiently allocate their time across different developmental stages doesn't mean that their less educated peers wouldn't do the same thing. But if this developmental gradient exists, then we should find, you know, gaps in the developmental gradient across parents' education groups. So highly educated parents could invest more time in basic care in infancy relative to the time they spend on basic care with children of older ages. But during infancy, if we then look within the period of infancy, we should see highly educated parents doing more of that activity relative to their less educated peers. And similarly for these other kind of activities for children at different developmental stages. We should see that the gap between highly educated parents and less educated parents should change over time, in other words, for children of different ages. And I'll just give you a preview. That's what we find. And if we, you know, having, and as I will show you that, then we will conclude that this education gradient that has been observed in the data historically is actually characterized by what we're calling this developmental gradient in turn. All right? Okay, so let's get to the seminar goes till 1:30. Okay, we have plenty of time. And interrupt all you want. So we're using data from the American Time Use Survey, which is an ongoing national survey conducted by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The data are actually available now up to 2010. So this is these are just cross-sectional data sets conducted every year. We're pooling together the data from 2003 to 2007, which reflects when we started this paper. The way the data are collected is that telephone interviews ask a randomly selected person age 15 or older to recount how he or she spent the previous day. The sample covers all days of the week and all months of the year. It collects, and you can account for the fact for whether the time diary was a weekday or a weekend interview. The data distinguishes primary from secondary activities, but actually the level of detail on the secondary activity is not as great as the level of detail on the primary activity, so we restrict our focus here just to primary activities with children. And also because we think by definition a primary activity requires the parent to be actively engaged in an interaction with the child. And I should say, as I said before, that it's not clear from research whether that is more beneficial to children's development than is sort of just being there and interacting, being around for the child in a secondary kind of activity. We're starting, you know, we're starting here with the primary activity because we can say what it is more specifically with these data. There's also high quality demographic information. So the ATUS is fielded in conjunction with the current population survey. So those data sets are linked. So you have all the high quality demographic information that's available in the CPS. We're going to control for just a handful of kind of exogenous covariates in our regressions. But the data, you know, by virtue of its size and knowing what everybody did over a 24-hour period, we think really offers a very rich opportunity to answer these kinds of questions. Okay, so we're just looking at mothers here, but one could easily do this same paper with fathers, and we actually have done that. We're working on that now, and I can just tell you now we see the same pattern of results, but much weaker when we look at whether there's a developmental gradient for fathers. So we restrict our sample here to women who have at least one child age 13 or younger in the home. We are only looking at time on the weekend here because we think that given the number of mothers who work, that weekend days sort of offer the greatest number of possible minutes to interact with your child. I should say when we combine weekdays and weekends, we see the same pattern of results. And then we exclude households who have stepchildren because there's a number of theories about why parental investments in stepchildren would differ in systematic ways than parental investments in own biological children, and so we exclude those small number of children. And so we have then about 6,640 mothers here, whom we divide into these four levels of education, as you can see here. And what we do is not only do we look at mothers with these different levels of education, but we then group children into these different age groups. Now, here is an important problem with the data is that when mothers report who they're interacting with in a parenting activity, you don't actually know which child the parent is interacting with. So this is, you know, from a developmentalist perspective, this is a big problem. You know, we know that parents are doing these activities, as I said, but not with whom they are engaged. So what we do is we use the youngest age of the child in the household as our sort of our grouping variable. So mothers with children ages zero, with at least one child in the zero to, whose youngest child is in the zero to two or any of the other two groups in the household, is grouped into that group with the argument that at least there's a child in the relevant age range for whom mothers might be interacting. But, you know, mothers may be saying they're doing basic care, and it could be that they're doing basic care for their teenager, and we don't actually know that. So, you know, this is a formula that Eric Hurst followed in a previous paper, and as I say, we follow it here. What we have done is we've tested the sensitivity of these results to one-child families, in which case we know that that's the... And the sample is much smaller, and we're, you know, the basic pattern of results is the same, but, you know, we didn't think that that bigger restriction made sense for talking about these kind of population-level trends. And then, as I say, given sample size, you know, I told you there was something special about, you know, the first year of life, the first 12 months. It turns out we can't really even look at that first year separately given our limited number of cases. So we have these three age groups here, you know, 0 to 2, 3 to 5, and 6 to 13. Yeah.
It is good to know that I think that your results hold for looking at all days because we know
yeah.
that young, less educated...
are more likely to work weekends. That's exactly right. That has come up before. That's exactly right. So we could be, you know, privileging, you know, the highly educated mothers who don't have to work on a Saturday or a Sunday. That's exactly right. And so that's, you know, we wanted to make sure that they held. Yeah, and so that's right. That's right. And, you know, we're not looking at any mechanisms or pathways here. So we're not going to control for income or maternal employment or any of that. But that's an excellent point, and we have thought of that.
On that, as I said that out loud, I started to think about, would there be any value in, as another way of measuring the input, what if you did something like, I was just thinking about the Mom on a Saturday thing.
Mm-hmm.
If I looked at the time she spent with her child as a share of her discretionary time,
yeah.
that might yield something. I mean, I'm not
right.
sure what
it's
that
a different
means, is that the right thing, but it is kind of an interesting
it is.
Between a sort of unnormalized hour.
Exactly.
Right?
We have thought of that, and we have, you know, we started out looking at shares
right.
of time here instead of levels,
right.
and we just...
Shares after taking out something.
Exactly, and it just, it gets complicated,
right.
But it's an equally valid way to look at this. As I say, we're just sort of comparing these mean number of minutes, but, right, you know, of the number of hours you're not working,
right.
how do you allocate that? Right. I mean, the concept is, yeah, I totally agree. Preferences or views of parenting or something, then maybe, you know, shares is right. Right. Yeah, Ross. Okay. Say it again. Yeah, no. Right. Right. Because somebody else might be. No, I totally agree, and I'm very interested in that kind of question. For that, what you need is a time diary from the child's perspective, which exists. So you have the PSID Child Development Supplement, which we were talking about this morning, has a time diary attached to it. And there you can look at all the inputs that the child is receiving from anyone who's interacting with the child. And you can very much see who's doing what, how that package of investments differs across different groups, but here it's the time diary of the adult. So, right, you should absolutely not take this as any sign of what children are getting, but rather it's what parents are doing. And that, you know, brings me to the next slide, because when I show this slide, people are always really shocked at how few minutes parents are engaged in, quote, you know, what I'm calling parenting as a primary activity. Okay, so the total number, this is now just pooling everybody together, those 6,600 people, respondents in my study, just taking all those kids across all ages and showing you, you know, the number of minutes that these mothers are engaged in primary activity that involves one of those activities that I told you about. And you can also see an example in the middle column of the kind of time use codes that we're using to kind of count parents as doing one of these four basic genres of parenting. And it, you know, it's certainly debatable that we could have coded this differently. We actually, again, followed John Gurian and Eric Hurst. They have a really nice paper with Melissa Kearney in the Journal of Economic Perspectives that just shows this education gradient, and we actually used their code. And you know, the ATUS doesn't get a lot more detailed than this, so there aren't many more choices for recoding. You know, so you can just see for yourself what kinds of time activities fall into basic care, play, teaching, and management. And you can see, and again, these are weekend days, you know, the numbers that mothers are engaged in these kind of activities are higher on weekends than weekdays. And you can see that mothers spend the most time in basic care and then in decreasing order play and teaching and management.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.